And welcome to this meeting of the Select Committee for Finance. We are correct, so I declare this meeting open. Are there any apologies, Secretary?
Wait, my man.
Are there written apologies for them? There's apologies for Honorable Mamela. Honorable Mashile is on his way in a plane from Nelspruit to Cape Town. And then Honorable Bloom. Can you accept these apologies? I put it to the committee. Yes? Thank you. Honorable members, that brings us to the purpose of this meeting is to deal with the annual report, firstly the annual report of National Treasury for the financial year 2010-2011, after that briefing by the Corporation for Public Deposits on their report on financial statements for the same financial year, 2010-2011, and then also a briefing by the Office of the Ombuds for Financial Services Providers on their report for the financial year 2010-2011. This committee will have a strategic planning session on the 15th and the 16th of May. There's a proposal that I as chairperson will take to the strat plan, that in future we deal with the annual reports in a joint meeting with the Standing Committee on Finance, because this is now history that we've got in front of us. And we are in the fifth month of the year, of the new year. So that's only a side remark. Welcome, Honorable Deputy Minister. Always welcome in this meeting with your whole team, the Director General, the Accountant General, and all the other supporting staff. Thank you for our committee section that prepared this meeting, all the preparations they did for us. I went through the annual report, that's the document, the thick document of National Treasury. There's a few issues that I highlighted myself. Coming out of this report is that South Africa continues to have the most transparent budget when surveyed against 94 other countries, including the most powerful economies in the world. So actually we are in the top echelons. I think that's a very important point that also comes out of this report. Also referred to in this report is international visits by the Minister, Deputy Ministers, Deputy Minister, the vacancy rate at 14%, etc., but I'm not presenting the report. Honorable Deputy Minister, over to you to make your input, and then you can proceed, please.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to all of you. Mine is going to be very simple. It's to introduce the accounting officer in terms of our legislation, the Public Finance Management Act, and also to indicate that the year under review on our annual report was a difficult year indeed, as you correctly pointed out. And so, as we report, I think the committee must just be alive to the economic climate under which we operated during that time. But also to indicate that the new administration has adopted the outcomes approach and under which we also operate, and which we think makes it even much easier for Parliament to hold us to account. And Chairperson, lastly, this is the first that we report both to the National Assembly and to the National Council of Provinces. So you will allow us space to make very reasonable mistakes if we are not responding directly to what you would expect of us as the Council of Provinces. But I present to you the accounting officer to do what...
Deputy Minister, thank you very much. I spoke to the Director General. The Auditor General made certain statements in his audit report to zoom into that. What did Treasury do in terms of the AG's findings? No question of your vacancy rates,
vacancy rate, the oversight over other departments to which you allocate money, the training levels 1 and 2, 3 and 3 to 5, page 269, a zero was evaluated, the whole issue of donor grants, to address the commentary on that, referring to page 251 in the annual report document per se. Consultation, consultancy fees that nearly doubled on also page 251. And then all the findings of the Auditor General. So over to you, PG. You're welcome.
Let me, I think in the interest of time, really summarize, because I think, you know, we prepared the presentation not knowing the specific things that you were interested in. So what I'm going to do is to try and go straight to the issues, almost even put the presentation aside. Perhaps save for referring you to the specific bits that you are interested in. Let's start with the vacancy rate issue. You will see on slide 17 on page 9 that we deal with the vacancy rate. Sorry? No, but I don't want to waste people's time. I mean, just telling you the stuff that you know, that the Treasury has got a budget office, and that program is responsible for producing the budget and stuff. You know that, Mr. Chairperson. I'll go almost straight to the issues that I've got that you are interested in. And then if I leave anything, I'm in your hands, you can still direct me and say, look, you have not responded to this which you are interested in. Are you happy with that? Okay. So if you look there, I mean, we the Treasury is quite a substantial organization now. Insofar as human resources are concerned, in the year in question, we had a staffing complement of 1,111 people. You get the breakdown there. The vacancy rate was around 14% for that year. You would see, honorable members, that in fact, if you look at the numbers of people that we offered, we made job offers to in that year, if you were to express it as also as a percentage of the establishment, in fact, it's bigger than the 14% that we started the year with as the vacancy rate, right? We made job offers of 199 job offers, of which 185 were accepted. There were declines of 14%. So a total of about 140 critical skills positions were filled in that financial year. Now, the difficulty with the employment staff is that, and I usually use my example as an example. When my predecessor left the department, the job got advertised. People applied. We were interviewed. I got appointed. Now, appointing me meant that another vacancy was created. So it's not on a net basis. You have not done anything to the vacancies in the department, but you have filled a position. Because in filling the one position, you created yet one vacancy. Then you advertise again. Then people apply. A chief director, Mr. Tuto Shumang, who was the head of liability management, in asset and liability management, was among the people who applied. Mr. Tuto Shumang gets appointed in that job. So on a net basis, the vacancy rate hasn't changed, but you have filled the position. Then you advertise again. In this instance, only when we advertise for chief director did we attract someone from outside. then you have made net employment. Now, if you think in terms of time, you know, time is moving. So that is what explains the issue of vacancies. Almost right across the board. In terms of the turnaround times, my colleague, the head of corporate services, could refer you to that. We are very quick. We process, we advertise through the shortlisting and appointment within the shortest possible time. In fact, I think we're one department that does these things quite quickly. I could say that. But of course, because of this explanation, then the vacancy rate cannot just disappear in one fell swoop. So I hope that I've dealt with that bit. Now, let's get to the consultancy fees stuff. The consultancy fees for the treasury itself that we use, you would see on slide 20 on page 10.
Yes.
Slide 20 on page 10, which is the bottom slide. We had two effects insofar as consultancy fees are concerned. In relation to the consultancy fees for the treasury, in other words, for our own internal processes where we hire consultants to help us where we are lacking in capacity, we had a saving. But the treasury under program 8, was it 7 or 8? 8. Under program 8, we run what we call the technical assistance unit. The technical assistance unit is helping us contribute towards giving expression to the goal of building an effective and efficient government. I think it's outcome 11 or 12. Outcome 11, right? Now, what does that technical assistance unit do? If a department has got a problem, say, with its supply chain management processes, or example that I don't quite like because it's too premature, but if you take public works with the state property management leases and stuff, that review, what this unit does, as per arrangement, it sources in the expertise that is lacking in other departments and then makes it available to those departments in the pursuance of their objectives. So as I said, if, for instance, then there's a department with a difficulty in one or another area, we hire the people, but not for ourselves as the treasury, to make those people available to the department. In an instance where capacity challenges exist quite widely in government, a program like this can actually be expected to expand instead of contract. And I don't think that it should be something that of necessity people should frown at. Because a program like this affords government the possibility to attract skills that it would otherwise not be able to attract within the salary scales that government has. What you would find here is that we are able to hire experts, but for shorter periods of time, at salary scales that are outside of the salary scales that prevail in government. Now, you hire them because you need them for government to work effectively and efficiently. But what then the program also affords you is the fact that you may not be saddled with having to have them for life, costing you too much. You have them when you need them. If you structure the contracts that you have with them appropriately, you have the possibility to have transfers of skills to some of the people who are already internal in government employed. So that explains then the issue of consultancy fees. But we can visit it if we need to. Now, I will refer you back to the presentation and probably stick to it for the next couple of slides. On page 11, slide 21. we make the point that overall we got an unqualified audit as a treasury for 2010-11, but there were some matters of emphasis. The regular expenditure of about 23.2 million. That the cumulative amount that relates to special pensions. I'll get to more details on this even more later on. And then we give the breakdown of what were the reasons for the regular expenditure. You know, 20.1 million related to instances where there was misinterpretation of the Special Pensions Act. 3 million relates to a company that was hired to do one bit of work, but then as a result of the agency, because the office environment where the special pensions were being processed was economically completely substandard, and it turned out that the company that did the scoping could also help with the partitioning and all that kind of stuff. Then it was asked to do that, and that is why then there was a further amount. Then there were also the 3.6 million in relation to material losses, again relating to criminal conduct within special pensions. Now, if you look at slide 22 then just sets out in details the findings by the SIU investigation in relation to the special pensions, which is the areas that then gave rise to the problem that the Auditor General made observations on. 518 beneficiaries were deceased. Of course, of 254 of those were subsequently removed from the system. 284 beneficiaries were indicated as having committed Schedule 1 offences, which are supposed to disqualify them for pensions. 141 fraud cases, 752 cases related to the misinterpretation of the Act. I mean, this last lot, by the way, is a more problematic lot, as you will see in the next set of slides. Now, what have we done? And I think this is probably the part that the committee may be more interested in than the history. Of course, the history is interesting because it's about what had gone wrong, but the most important thing is what has been done about what has been identified as having gone wrong. We instituted a process between ourselves and the Government Pensions Administration Agency, which process has led to the stopping of 518 of these pensions, where people were deceased and somehow the money was finding way to accounts of whoever they may be, or whether it's people were cheating and stuff like that. But what was then since done was to remove all of those of those people, and you can see the breakdown provided there. Now, the where there is a difficulty, if you go, I mean, don't want to bore you with the rest of the details, but they are there for everyone to see. Where we have a difficulty in cleaning up this system of special pensions now is in relation to the instances where there was a misinterpretation of the Act by the board that was duly constituted. The difficulty in relation to that, which we have discussed with the AG, and we are still looking at options of how to deal with it in a manner that is consistent with the law, but at the same time ensures that the process of administering special pensions is fully compliant with the relevant statutes, is the fact that the 752 people, we can't just stop. We need to go to a high court. That's the interpretation that we've got. In order for the High Court to order that their pensions be stopped. Now, we're at a stage where, I mean, when I began this with you here, we are weighing now the options, because the costs don't treat them as a group, because each person's instances have got to be looked at on their own merit. So it's going to be legal time, legal costs, and then on each case there is a determination. From the legal advice that we've sought, there is even an indication that in law it might well be that if I, Lungisa Fuzile, get a pension for as long as these people have got this pension due to the misinterpretation of a law by a person duly appointed by the authorities that have got the power, I've got a reasonable expectation to receive that pension until I die. Now, we're then at the point where we've got to weigh this. I mean, do we incur the cost only to be told this thing? Or do we incur the cost and hope that we may be lucky to then reach a stage where we can get the High Court to say, stop the pensions, in which case then we would benefit and be able to save the state. So in this regard, we have approached the Department of Justice to see how they could assist us in fast-tracking this thing. But it can be expected that it's going to take a long time, it can be costly, and judgment calls will have to be made along the way. Whatever judgment calls they've got to be made, you know, got to balance the issue of costs, the legality of what we're doing, and so on and so forth. There was a small issue that no one has referred to, which was about the quarterly report, I think it was, Daru, which the Auditor General had raised. In the interest of transparency, I might as well draw your attention to it. It's one of these reforms that are new, and I think that it's not too helpful to be fighting about form on these things. The reports are supposed to sort of reflect the progress we're making on a quarterly basis towards achieving the objectives that we've set ourselves. I mean, if you think about it, the biggest business of the Treasury relates to money. The transfers we make to provinces, the transfers we make to municipalities, those get reported on a quarterly basis in any way. They have been done almost as run-of-the-mill stuff since the ages of the introduction of the Section 32 report for provinces, Section 40, I think, for national government, Section 71 reports insofar as municipalities are concerned, Section 71 of the MFMA, that is. So the financial information, it's not, there are no qualms about it. It's the non-financial information which the AG had raised issues about. And we believe, and you will see for the financial year now that has just ended, 2011-12, I hope that the finding in so far as that is concerned will be a marked improvement relative to what they had observed the previous year. Because we have spoken, we took the trouble to say, let's sit and ask them to look at the report, and if they feel that the report still miss the information in the manner in which they were concerned in 2010-11, then they should indicate to us where the shortcomings are so that we could improve it. So far, they have not complained. But we will know once they do the report again whether they are satisfied. If they are not, we'll again work hard to try and improve the quality of those. Bearing in mind that some of the work of the Treasury is not kind of the kind of work that you can say it makes sense to measure on a quarterly basis, by the way. But we don't want to overplay that point. You can get quarterly GDP growth figures, you can work out how much debt you have raised or how much funding you have done end of the quarter and those kinds of things, but in reality, those things really matter once you have got the year behind you, because you then know how much revenue you would have collected, how much debt you raise, how much your debt service cost will be, because at any given point interest rates could fluctuate and so on and so forth. Let me pause there, Chair. If there are specific things that I've missed out of the things that you would have liked me to zoom in on, then we can zoom on those. If there are questions on other areas, then you can. But at the same time, if any of my colleagues think that I've, including my boss here, have missed something, then they can feel free to raise it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, DG. With such a very comprehensive report. For the sake of clarity, I'm on your slide, is it page 9, 17. The last bullet says there is an effort to recruit more people with disability through the relevant network. If possible, can you indicate at least how many in the different genders? Another question. Oh, okay. This material loss. No, this is understood. But the issue of cases, your page 12, you know, these legal terms seem to confuse people. Of these 85 cases which were stopped at the end, how did this case stop? It stopped, not to continue, but I see the explanation here. When now the judges, the retired judges, were instituted in order to carry on with these cases, but I don't understand. Will you please just try to elaborate this stopping and yes, just to come out clearly. Thanks, Chairperson.
No, thanks, Chair. I was still trying to understand the question I want to raise, but under slide 17, the human capital, I just want to understand in relation to what the DG explained earlier on, the net difference when you view some of this process. The 185 offers accepted, does that represent filled posts, or it's a combination of the 140 critical skills that were filled and the difference of 45 merely indicates the movement within? I need clarity on that. And, because reading the two together, I can't understand. On slide 21, yes, I just want to understand, DG, as to what is it that exactly the board misinterpreted here, and whether such a misinterpretation was an interpretation based on any legal opinion obtained, or it was merely on the thinking of the board without necessarily seeking a legal opinion or interpretation of whatever that needs to be interpreted there. Now, that will be the question insofar as that is concerned. And with your program relating to the training of people from municipalities and provinces and the numbers that you have reached in terms of offering such training, one would want to know if there is any reported instances of such people who have been trained in those institutions being permanently employed or being remain interns even after being capacitated and all those things. And the last question here would relate to the audit report of opinion. I know it's unqualified, but it's not clear. a national treasury is regarded as one of the best, one of the departments that everybody should look up to, and would expect by now that, notwithstanding the challenges, but at least you cruise on clean audits, which seems to be a challenge for everybody, to the extent that some of us are convinced that we are unlikely to achieve it by 2014, as said. Now, if National Treasury also gets unclean audit reports, one wonders as to who can be cited as an example. I take note of the two or three departments that have got clean departments at national level, clean audits, but I'm a bit concerned if you still find unclean reports in Treasury itself, particularly national. Provincial, we understand they are very weak, those ones. I'm sure everybody has come to accept that provincial treasuries are weak and still lack the required capacity to reach to a level where we can say they can make an impact. So that's my last question, Chair. Yeah.
Honourable Lees.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. My questions in large part have been covered, but suffice it to say that it's off-putting when the DG is so efficient and then answers our questions. I can't go to sleep. I mean, I've got to listen to everything he's saying because he's very specific in answering our questions. So thank you. That's a compliment, DG. It's not an insult. But thank you very much for that. The only question I think that perhaps it's really a matter of clarification, because the use of the word cases, I think, started from Honourable Commissioner there, in the sense that there's a question of the use of the term of a case in terms of someone being paid the pension, and a case in terms of someone being criminally investigated. Or so perhaps a little bit of clarity on that might assist. But I think everyone, I've got the misrepresentation. In terms of the Honourable Chane has indicated that your technical assistance unit is assisting the local government and province, although you didn't say that. So he's much better qualified than I am. So I assume that's right, that your assistance unit at national is assisting everyone right down to local government level. But I've already got the answer to that from Honourable Chane. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Honourable Lees. Turning to page 27 of the annual report, the document itself, you referred to the monitoring evaluation regarding the implementation of the Workbooks project. I just want to mention to National Treasury that my experience this year, 2012, January, February, was a bit scaring when I visited the 15 schools in my constituency in the Northern Cape province. And it's not a localized problem. It seemed to me a national thing about the workbooks and the CAPS, the books for CAPS, referring to education, that it was not received on the specific dates as indicated by that department, the Department of Basic Education. And it impacted on the program of education in those schools. So that you take note of that. It was given to me that the workbooks were ordered from a central point, and they're going back to the old system of to decentralize it. That was engagement I had with my MEC in the Northern Cape, Honorable Chikela, as the MEC for Education, now the Acting Premier. I just want to pass that on to National Treasury. Then on page 86 and 87 of the annual report, referring to the infrastructure grant to provinces, could you elaborate and indicate to the committee on your efforts to assist provinces in spending the infrastructure grant and the lessons learned in the past, which include KZN, Limpopo, Northwest and Western Cape? And then referring to page 87, the local government financial management grant, the impact of this grant in improving the financial management capacity in municipalities, and the strategy that you that you followed is also with referring to interns, etc. Thank you, teacher. You can respond to that.
Let me, so that I don't catch my colleagues by surprise, I'll request that Mr. Mgomezulu, if he has found the numbers on the people with disabilities and breakdowns, should say, just take you through that when I finish, but if he has any information that we can be able to finish in writing beyond that. I'll request the Accountant General to just deal with the financial management grant implementation in municipalities. Let me take the other questions. I suppose it could be considered bad use of English because it's cases. I suppose you can say instances of people who, because there is also an issue of cases in court. So we apologize for that. But essentially, what we are referring to, what we have, I would split these cases to summarize. I would split it now into two categories. There is the category that we've been able to stop. In other words, all other categories where there were people who were receiving or where there were monies paid which ought not to have been paid, whether it's dead people, deceased people, or some other irregularity. That's the one lot. So you then get, for instance, if you look at let's say slide 24, right? You could just draw a line that the whole lot of people in the top bullet, 141, fraud cases, stopped. Similarly, if you go to the top, the 518, where we've dealt with that, the only people where we still have a problem is the 752, essentially. It's the instances where people were, which gets to the other question that the committee asked, where the committee applying the law awarded the benefits to people who ought not to have received the benefit. Those are the people that have got a difficulty with. Now, Honorable Sana is asking the question, are these people, is it the misinterpretation? I would presume it's a whole lot of the instances. I mean, essentially what we've had here is a case where the SIU went through each one of the files and found that, correctly interpreted, the law doesn't allow this person to get the benefit, and this one and the other one. Now, as to the specific of each person, I can't tell you that for the first one, for the second one, it's this. The one most common case relates to this Schedule 1 offenses, where because people had committed those Schedule 1 and were supposed to have been disqualified, but they are getting. But some of them, it's because of age at that stage. People ought to have been a certain age in order to qualify. So there were those kinds of misinterpretations. Now, the difficulty, which gets to the issue that people raise, we can't disown this thing. I can't walk away from it. It says the National Treasury Director General is responsible for this stuff. But I didn't appoint the board. Neither did my predecessor, by the way. It's one of those situations. So at least one has got to slip that one in so that it's understood. But I still have, I can't walk away from this, I still have the overall responsibility to see to it that things happen orderly within this thing, because the law still makes me accountable for it. There's a difficulty with matters of law. Emotionally, you might feel that you just want to terminate this pension, but the law doesn't work on emotions. It's a prescribed process that you've got to follow, And it is only after we have followed that process that we would find the right way to deal with these people. And I mean, I would say, other than the issues that relate to special pensions, the Treasury is probably not a very bad example insofar as financial management is concerned, by the way. But people can take what they want from this. We manage a budget of quite a substantial budget for ourselves, which is just over $1 billion. But we also manage transfers to various parts of government. We do these things without a single error, right? The documents that we present to you in Parliament, which have been commended worldwide, are documents that are almost error-free. So the point one is making is that, yes, this is a blemish that we don't like, but the choice is ours whether we want to use it and magnify it and give the impression that the Treasury is therefore useless, or we give it the character that it has, which is it's a small thing which sits outside of the Treasury where there were forces that came in between the Treasury, by the way, and running that because of the way the structure is created. But anyway, that's enough on that. The people that get trained, insofar as them staying, we know that some of them stay. I mean, I wouldn't know the number. But I can tell you that in our own internship program at the Treasury, about 85%, roughly, of the people who come fresh from university, technicons, they enter as interns. Not large numbers, but 85% or so of them, they end up getting jobs with us. Some of them, even before they finish a year of the internship, they get taken up by other departments. And so far as what happens with these ones, 71% is the right percentage. Insofar as those that go to municipalities, I mean, I don't know the retention rate there. It may be something that the Accountant General knows or something that we could check to the extent that it interests members. So let me, on the Technical Assistance Unit, Honorable, it's very rare that we receive requests or accede to requests from municipalities, actually. We use it mainly for national government. Insofar as supporting municipalities and provinces on infrastructure delivery, especially provinces, we have been running this program called Infrastructure Delivery Improvement Program, which started, I think, about 7-8 years ago, in which we hire, as the National Treasury, experts in project management, engineering, and so forth. And then we make these available to four categories of departments, or four departments, provincial treasuries, departments of education, departments of health, departments of public works. The success of this program has been mixed. If for instance, one takes a province like Limpopo, not because he became the Minister of National Minister of Health now, but when Minister Mutswaledi, Minister of MEC for Education in Limpopo, we made massive progress in terms of helping build capacity in that province, and you could see it on the ground. The extent to which these kinds of programs work depends on the reception from the parties that are supposed to get help. Because you can't impose yourself when you're going to help. So we sort of try to work with the people who say, look, we've got this expertise. Most people first take long to admit that I have got a shortcoming here and help me. Until such time that it is obvious that there's going to be huge underspending and money is going to be lost, then people accept the help. Sometimes a lot of time has been lost already. But the program still continues to run, we can scale it up. We want to even encourage provinces to take up these people now on their own to the extent that they can get them. You would have seen that in the year in question, we stopped about 2 billion in the infrastructure grant to provinces, precisely because we anticipated that there was going to be underspending of this grant.
Thanks, TG. Maybe let me start with the support to municipalities, just to finish off what DG was saying. In terms of the structure in the municipalities, you have 17 non-delegated municipalities where the Treasury provides support directly as National Treasury. And then the rest of the municipalities, the support is provided via the provinces. But even in that structure, there is a working relationship between the Treasury and the provincial treasuries, as well as the departments of local government and traditional affairs. They are titled differently in different provinces. That creates that support structure for the municipalities. So you've got that. And there's various programs that get run throughout the year to make sure that happens. The financial management grant is one such program, which has grown quite substantially from 2009, where it used to be just over 500 people that would participate in this employed by municipalities, and now it's sitting at about 1,300 or so interns. Some of them get employed permanently. If necessary, we'll try and get the numbers. It's difficult, though, to track that. One of the challenges in people being employed permanently is that sometimes chief financial officers are not the people that always agree with things that are asked to be done when, in fact, those things are not following a particular process that is prescribed in law. So retaining such skills becomes very difficult sometimes. So that should be understood also in that background. But there has been a number of them that were retained. Some of them have moved from various municipalities to operate in other departments at other municipalities. They get appointed in other municipalities from the municipalities where they started. So that project is, in fact, contributing positively in ensuring that there are skills in government. There are conditions before the money is transferred, so it's monitored quite closely to ensure that before that money is transferred, the municipality has in fact employed the relevant people. A small portion of this money is used to create space as well for additional capacity in what you call the graduate, to create additional capacity to ensure that there is more experienced support given to municipalities. This is in the form of the experts that have been appointed, there are about 42, and they help clusters of municipalities around the country. So that's roughly how the project works, and it, as I've said, it has grown. There was an issue, and I want to use an example in my office as well to just emphasize the issue around the feeling of vacancies that the DG talked about, that we see more and more in the Treasury that you find people being promoted. So they come in at a lower level and they get promoted to higher positions. And when that happens, then you are going to still remain on a net basis with a vacancy. And then DG, you did not address the critical skills. I think here, There are certain positions that relate to the core functions of the Treasury, and there are positions that relate to support functions within the Treasury. In other words, people that work in budget office, people that work in those of the Accountant General, and so on, those would be the core functions of the Treasury. And those positions, we try by all means to always fill those positions and not have vacancies there. So the differentiation between 185 and 140 relates to 140 positions related to the core functions, and the remainder of the positions related to the support functions within the treasury. So that's that part should be understood, in that context. I think I have. Yes, I think I've addressed the questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the issue of employability of persons with disabilities, I'd like to draw your attention to page 275 of the annual report. 275. There's a table there that deals with our annual recruitment for the period under review. You would notice that for the whole 12 months, we only managed to employ one person with a disability, African male. However, it has come to our attention, and obviously with experience, that it is not necessarily always true that the people we employ do not have a disability. It is a challenge for people to disclose a disability, any type of disability, and we have recognized that as a challenge. There is a stigma attached to being classified as a person with disability. Now that's where our networks with relevant groupings that deal with disabilities came into play. We have engaged NGOs that deals with people with disabilities. These NGOs, we have a close working relationships with them. We have enhanced our employment equity committee or forum, if you like. The outcome of that is that as we speak now, in our numbers, we can disclose 15 people with disabilities in the treasury. And that was as a result of our effort to de-stigmatize disability. Therefore, internally, without even going out to employ people, the number has increased to 15 because we made people aware that disability is not a bad thing. In fact, if anything, it could be a potential benefit to employees. So people are now coming forward to disclose their disabilities. In terms of gender, we have 55% females and 45% males. Overall, the 15% of, I mean, the 15 people in relation to treasury's staff complement is just over 1.3%. It's a very minute number. However, if the committee members need the details, you know, in terms of levels, gender, and other things, that can be provided. But this is at a high level. In terms of what was the last thing 3 minutes spoke about?
Critical skills.
No, not critical skills. I needed to talk about that. Let me leave it there. That's fine.
Bella.
Chairperson, it is very interesting to notice that the DG owned the report with those staff. It's very good. It shows the inside of the report. I'm having a practical case here. I think when you were explaining, it reminded me to one of my people who voted for us. This family, they are pensioners. They were working in the government, you know, but the wife was not working from the beginning until she attained the age of getting that grant. This old man was appointed as an MP in the parliament, and the pension for the wife was stopped. Is there any Can we get explained, is there any law which determines that?
Jefferson,
can we quickly check Honorable Chani and Lisa, and then you can respond.
I wanted to request a special dispensation for Dr. Makwell, that his matter be dealt with. If he could actually give us the details, so that we do not want to give a general response to a question like that. It's a specific question that relates to it, because we might just say there is no law that says that, and when you study the circumstances surrounding the matter, you find that it was legitimate that that be done. So if we give a response, a general response here, we go out there, and when we find that it had to happen like that, and then we're not in it. It's a special dispensation just for you, Dr. Makubela, so that you deal with your constituents, the people that voted for you. Thanks.
Honorable Makubela, yes, you can draft it and give it to us here at the table, and we can pass it on to Teresa. Yes. Honorable Chani, and then Honorable Lee.
No, Chair, thanks very much, and I appreciate the answers to my questions. They are small questions, but I'm sure the fact that they are small should be understood in the context that anything that becomes big later has started small. And there's no difference between somebody who stole 20 rand and the one who stole 1 million. The fact of the matter, the two of them have committed crime. The degree thereof is immaterial. So we are raising this in that context. Now, I want to come the issue relating to employment. You are reporting that you had a vacancy of 179, but it would appear that your intention was to employ 199, 20 more. I'm interested to know, why do you want to employ more than what you have, and why that those were, because I would assume the 179 was funded posts. Now you went beyond that target. The question is why and whether you had those extra 20 were funded, or what is the situation there? There are other people who are doing these things, and they will always want to say, no, even Treasury does these things. And they do massive employment themselves. I don't want to mention provinces by name, we all know them. But that's one question. Now, coming back to the question of the board, I would want to know, I'm interested on the, because I saw you earlier on relied on the SIU legal opinion, but you also, SARS and yourself, your legal people confirmed what the SIU lawyers are saying. But are you saying, or are they saying, that Special Pensions Act does not or prohibits the board in execution of their fiduciary duties not to correct itself? Because I would imagine that if the board has also come to a conclusion where they believe that they add in terms of making sure that people who are not supposed to receive this money to receive this money can, by way of resolution, correct themselves. But it would appear that in this instance it's so difficult that you even have to go take this matter to the court. If you can explain to me that, because sitting here, I think it could be a matter of the board itself correcting itself, and the matter is closed. Now, this legal opinion seeks to suggest to me that it is okay by law to benefit Iranians. And I don't think that is the case by law. I'm not a lawyer, but I doubt if there is any law that allows that. Otherwise, these people who are on the SASA system, having access to pension funds and child grants, wouldn't have just been taken out of the system, because everybody would say, no, let's wait for the High Court to declare that individual so should not be on the system, it was wrong. Why, in terms of the pension fund with SASA, people, it was easy to remove them and even to charge them? I know the circumstances are not the same, TG. Others do it deliberately, but here is a mistake of the board that can be corrected by the same board.
but you are told you must go to court. Meantime, these people are benefiting when they are not supposed to. It's not huge amounts, but a lot of money. So I would want to be clarified there, Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Honorable Chane has kind of elaborated on this. I think perhaps the difficulty comes when it's referred to as a misinterpretation, because your answer to me sounded like it was an error, in fact. When someone, I don't know what the regulations, the act says, but let's say you have to be over 35 and an applicant is under 35 and is granted the pension. That's not a misrepresentation, a misinterpretation. That's a simple error. And so I'm now a little bit confused. I was happy in the beginning when you said misinterpretation, because, I mean, that's a legal thing. Now you read something and you have one interpretation, I have another. But when it's a question of, are you over 35? No, I'm not. But anyway, I'll give you the pension. That's either fraud or it's an error. And it sounds to me like these were considered by SIU to be errors rather than fraud. But within there, maybe there are some. You didn't, obviously, not able to give 752 issues. I mean, you were giving us some examples. I understand that. And there might well be, yeah. But so that's why Honorable Chana and I are now getting a bit concerned about exactly what is this all about. And so that clarity. But, you know, it's can you just clarify for me, the question of let's assume the decision is we don't stop the pensions, we don't go to court, we just say this it's just not cost effective. Am I interpreting it correctly then in saying in 2010-11 the cost was $220 million for those 752, I think. If you could clarify. So we can anticipate then that this $20 million will grow with inflation, and it could go on for 20 or 30 years? Or is it likely to stop after 5 years, you know, when they die or what, something happens? What? I know it's a difficult question for you to answer. I'm sorry I'm being you know, perhaps you should give a written reply, but maybe you can give me some feeling about that. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Honorable Lees. And then on page 251 of the annual report, just for clarity's sake, you refer to the Department of Oceans and Tourism. I don't know of such a department in South Africa. Departments of Oceans and Tourism, it relates to an amount of 300,000, if I'm correct. Just clarify that department. Is it in this country or which country are you talking about? It's receivables on page 251.
May I respond?
Yes, yes.
No, that's what is not too difficult to do. Sorry.
Okay, before he confirms the Department of Oceans and Jen, let me try and contextualize the issue of the Board of the Special Pension. Because, in fact, most of the problems arise because of the nature of the special pensions. Special pensions being a political dispensation, it had its problems at the beginning, particularly because if you take how the board was constituted, yes, it was appointed by the minister, but political parties had to submit names of people whose credentials could only be verified by the political parties. As a result, you would have people whose skills could not be determined by, you can only serve in a board if you are fit and proper in respect of that particular line. So we did have a board that actually did not meet government requirements only, but only had also had to meet the political requirements of each political party represented. And as a result, some of the misinterpretations, it was actually found that it's through lack of understanding of these issues when you're given legislation to implement. And it was very clear that to qualify for special pensions, you have to be of a particular age, you must have served your organization for a particular period, unbroken at that time. But also, if you have found to have contravened Schedule 1, or committed Schedule 1 offenses after 1990, you would be disqualified. So in some instances, the board then took a decision to award people who otherwise did not meet the entire criteria. And when those people were paid, and the DJ was saying that it is not possible to say exactly, unless we provide you with a schedule exactly of the 752 to indicate exactly what was the misinterpretation. It is, I don't think our examples will be very accurate here to say it might have been because of age. I don't think we would, that would have happened. But it's instances where the board had, in its wisdom, you know, approved the pension. But on investigation of all these cases, it was found that they don't meet the entire criteria, so this person is not entitled. So now the problem that the DG says it's difficult to terminate because the entitlement on the side of the recipient can be challenged in court, because if the board in its wisdom had ruled that I qualify, it's not that the board now says they accept the error or they don't accept the error. It is that in terms of the law, in applying the law, you did not, this person did not meet the qualifications. And in terminating it, then he used some legal terminology which says then that the person would now, in terms of entitlement now, have reasonable expectation to receive, because the board in its wisdom had ruled that I qualify. So if it's a matter that, if challenged, could actually pose problems. Until there is a court ruling on the matter, it is difficult for the termination. But once these matters have been dealt with and concluded by the courts, that this is the situation, I think we would then have legal ground to be able to terminate those cases. It is just the nature of it, and it's something that we have cleaned up, and as we speak now, the board has actually since ceased to operate, because it is now in the fold of the pensions administration. But it's one of the problems that we encountered during that time because of the political nature of the special pensions dispensation. And as the DG said, you know, at times it's very difficult when you also carry the sins of the others to be entirely clean. And therefore, even the crucifixion comes as a result of carrying other people's sins. Thanks.
Honorable Chairman, a follow-up?
DG is still going to give the further technical outcome. Yes, on the same one, yeah. I was just giving them, I mean, I was actually trying to contextualize it, but allow the DG first perhaps if he raises a follow-up so that if he didn't cover it. Then.
No, the curious thing about that act is that in the wisdom of the drafters, it had a clause which said the board's powers were unfettered. And then the interpretation was whatever decision the board has taken cannot be changed by any organ of state, blah, 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 almost paraphrasing. If you think about the way the Deputy Minister was saying, I mean, there must have been difficulties in taking decisions within that board, given how it was constituted also. So it's not an easy thing. Now that the board, by the time this stuff hit the point at which it got to be this problem, the board no longer existed. So you can't go back and reconstitute it to reverse the decisions that it took. The only option we seem to have in law is this one of checking whether a court can help us reverse the decision, with all the attendant risk insofar as the time that it would take, the cost, and the possibility that, given that those people had applied to a board that was duly constituted, exercising its mind, decided that those people deserved the grants, then those people could challenge it, and or say, you know, the court could say they have a reasonable expectation to receive the grant until they die. We have not given up. We're going to explore all of these options. But as I was emphasizing, in exploring them, as much as we would like to have a clean audit, What we cannot do is to be insensitive and disregard the law and just say, you know, want a clean audit 252, stop today and stuff like that. I mean, then the embarrassment that would come with such things being taken to court and reflecting that we didn't follow the law when it was clear, actually, would have more negative consequences than going through all the necessary steps that are available in law to deal with the issue. The amount is cumulative. In other words, the amount that you see here is in the total payments over a period of time. Being a cumulative amount, it can only increase and then stop. Once the people say die or something, then they come out of the system, then it will reach that stage. Let me explain the issue of vacancies. The numbers that we set out here, Mr. Chan, and I can see now why they are confusing. Net employment in 2010-11 was 20%. In other words, we started the year with 1111 people. We wanted to employ 179. So if you added the two numbers, you would have arrived at the number that was going to be our total employment for the year. But because there were resignations, retirements, transfers, whatever you call them, some people leaving, although we employed 199, on a net basis, we only reduced the vacancy rate of 179 by 20. That's the point I was explaining. Am I making sense now? You start the year with, if we can write the numbers down, you start the year with X, let's just put X, and your vacancy rate is 179. So if you fill all your 179 posts, then your total employment will be X plus 179. But X is not constant, because people can leave the system. So if you hold everything constant and X decreases, your vacancy rate becomes higher. 179 becomes a bigger number.
It becomes 199.
So then we employed in total in that year 199 people. Right? In other words, we issued letters of employment. But some of the letters are to people like me who has been in the Treasury. So when you fill a vacancy with someone who is within, you have not reduced the vacancy rate. All you have done is to create it at a different level because you have promoted the one person. So we reduced for that year the vacancy rate by the 20, which is the difference between the actual number we employed and the vacancy rate that we started with. So we employed 199 against a vacancy rate of 179, which means that the other 179 simply offset the movement in terms of resignations and promotions.
So your vacancy rates at the end of the year was 1%.
Yes. Now, but
just as all the rest of the world.
Yeah. Can I quickly?
Can we get an accountant to reconcile the
numbers? Yeah. The problem that you're going to have, Honorable Chan, is that some of the filling of the vacancies is the internal promotions. If you look at page, I think it's page 275 or something, of the annual report, it shows a number of people that actually got out of the Treasury. What you don't have is the number of promotions inside the Treasury. So the reconciliation that you're trying to make is going to be difficult without knowing the number of promotions. I can see where your problem is.
Make it difficult. You see, if you say at the beginning of the year you had 179 vacancies, and then during the year 100 left, you now have 279 vacancies. But of that 279, you then promoted 100 from within. the number remains 279. Right? And then if out of 279 you only employ 20, you are left with 259. It's simple. It does not, I'm not confused. So here I'm saying you had 179 vacancies, but you employed 185. You had planned to employ 199, but unfortunately because others declined, you only employed 185. Now you are saying, and then you are saying, of that 185, 140 was critical post, I assume. But let me forget about the 140 and say it's 185 vis-a-vis 179. But then the DG is saying, out of that 185, only 20 made a dent to the original 179. Which then means you still have got a vacancy rate of 159 people. The rest of the other numbers is just an internal movement. So the way it is captured here is the thing that is not correct.
I think the point here is the concept is the filling of vacancies. It's not the number of people employed. If we're talking the filling of vacancies, this is correct. But if we're talking about the number of people employed, then we're going to talk aggregate numbers. And that will give us the 159 that he is talking about.
Okay,
but if we're talking about filling of the vacancies, promoting someone as he made an example about himself, promoting someone to a position that has been left vacant by the departure of someone is the filling of the vacancy. It's not the employment of a person. So at times you will find that the two will work together where the filling of the vacancy also means the employment of a person. In this instance, it's the question relates to the filling of vacancies. And as it relates to the filling of vacancies, these figures are accurate. But if you want to then talk to the employment figures, how many people did you employ and how many people did you not have in the establishment, then you will talk absolutely.
So then actually another table.
But whilst I have the floor, I had indicated that the Standing Committee on Finance requires that I answer for my sins at exactly 11 o'clock. Can I be released and leave the capable officials?
Deputy Minister indicated to me before we started, and I gave him permission to leave the meeting to attend to the Standing Committee for Finance meeting. Honorable Chani, the last remark.
No, Chair, I think it's important that this report, because you see, we read this report independently, away from National Treasury. So we should be able to understand them. And interpretation should not be the only one who understand their own report. You see? Now, my simple question is, can you unbundle that 185? What is contained in that 185? Then perhaps in that way it will be simple. Because that's why you say to me, out of this 185, 20 is new employment. One so-and-so is filling of vacancies. You see, this English sometimes causes unnecessary confusion. So that unbundles that 185 for me, so that I can be able to relate it to the actual vacancies that needs to be filled by way of bringing people outside. Because ultimately, whether you make internal movements, for you to be able to feel that 179, you will have to get people from outside. You see? That is the bottom line. There's no other way that you can be able to feel that 179 if you don't get people outside. Either to replace those positions or the positions of those who might have been promoted to fill those ones.
But just go one step further to add on to your reply. To National Treasury, this gentleman indicated long ago he wants to say something. Are you covered? Yes, Mr. Nombalu.
Sorry, can I just quickly point out, if you go to page 272 and 273 of the annual report.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, no, of course. The movement, remember.
DG, I think you might just take us through, because not everyone's got the book in front of them. This book was circulated in 2011.
Yeah. Okay. The starting point is that when the DG made a comparison now, the number of 20, he was deriving that number from 199 and 179. So let's not spend too much time on 20 as a number. The numbers here on page 272, if you look at the top table 5.3, employees 31st March 2010, 1,073 employees. Right? And so whatever the vacancy rate was at that time, I don't have that. I would have that on the access report. And then on table 6.1, the total number of employees, 31st of March 2011, has moved up to 1,111 employees. The net employment is 34 employees. So the increase, having taken everything into account, internal promotions, and if you've taken the recruiting people from outside, if you've taken people that have resigned, the net increase in the number of employees employed by Treasury is 34. So that number 34 is the number that you can then reconcile in terms of the movements, promotions, resignations, retirements, and all of that. The total number of vacancies we have as at 31st March 2011 is 179. The number that we don't have is the reference number, which is in last year's annual report, the reference number for last year, which is the start position. The 179 is the end position, 31st of March 2011. Now, the 185 is the number of people that were employed between 1st of April 2010 and 31st of March 2011. Yes?
The number of people to whom offers were made.
To whom offers were made and accepted those offers. No?
But that's the precise English. No.
No, wait.
And after that, we'll take another questions because we're running now into the time of the other department that must appear before us.
No, that's actually the point. I mean, we made offers to 199 people, of which 185 accepted. The 185 does not distinguish whether you were offered when you were inside the treasury already or outside. It's just the total number of people who, following due process, to whom offers were made and they accepted. And 34 came from outside.
Wait.
Yeah?
34 is the net position. If you take the 185 alone, just for argument's sake, theoretically, let's say 40 of those were people that were already inside the treasury. Remember, you've got resignations. The number 34 is a net effect of the 185 and the people that resigned and the people that were promoted internally. But 34... If you look at 34, if you look at everything else, Treasury had 1,073 people at the beginning of the year. At the end of the year, it's got more people, which means all of the movements that took place have resulted in 34 more people being in the Treasury. But it doesn't mean that the new people in the Treasury, people that have never been in the Treasury, are 34. They are at least 34. Yes.
Spend 20 minutes now on this issue. On the Charlie?
No, you see, Chair, I'm still repeating, this is a simple matter. But Treasury, you see, the Accountant General speaks this language, the DG, they use different words. The other says field, the other says employ, the other says 34, the other says 20. They are the ones confusing people. See, all what I wanted to understand, you see, if we are to take your opening figure
as at the 31st of March, was 1073, the closing fee. Right?
March 2010.
Yes, March 2010. Then this other one relates to March 2011.
Yes.
At the end of March 2011, and I'll assume if this was the last figure at 12 o'clock midnight to 2013, 1 minute past 12, the figure was still the same.
Yes.
I guess.
Yes.
So it's an opening a figure.
Yes.
Now, there was a movement from 1073 to 1111. And then you said that is a difference of 34. So, meaning new 34 people were employed.
No,
meaning at least 34 new people were employed. But when you then look at the number itself, there's a number of permutations that make up the 34. All that 34 means is that Treasury has increased the number of people that are physically inside the building by 34. Not quite. You might find, say, that when you go to the Treasury, there's about 70 new people that have never been in the Treasury. But because there's also another number that resigned, and there are people that moved from one position and so on, and those things result in the net position being 34, increasing the number of people in the Treasury.
Right. At least you want us to qualify, let's say at least 34 new people.
Yes.
Now, the question I'm saying is that at least 34 new people were employed. How does that figure then impact on the 179 figure of vacant positions?
Okay.
That's
yes.
To
okay. Now, the point I'm making, say, in explaining this is that 179, as at the 31st of March 2011,
right.
We know there's 1,111 people in the Treasury. We also know that Treasury is supposed to be 1,179 people, 1,111 people plus 179, because the 179 is the figure as at the end of 31st of March. So the vacancy rate 31st of March, the 14% is on a different page. Where's the page? Because it's better to talk to the numbers that are in the book, because those are the numbers that have been audited and the page 267. Okay. The difference between the number of funded posts of 1290 and 1111 is 179. So as at end of March 2011, that is the vacancy rate. So the 34 has not had an impact on the 179, but has had an impact on a similar number that was at the 31st of March 2010. So that's the point that I was stepping in to clarify.
Then
easy calculation. If the staff complement didn't change from the beginning to the end of the year, so we're saying 1,290 were the staff complement. The start of the year, the actual people employed was 1,073. So the vacancies at the beginning of the year were 1,290 minus 1,073 gives you 217 vacancies at the beginning of the year, 179 vacancies at the end of the year. I hope that assists it.
That's a calculation done by an accountant.
As my challenge here with the 185, that's why I was saying, perhaps for me to understand, but Honorable Lee at least now, if Treasury agrees with him, then he answers me.
So if you are cutting,
Honorable members, can we please go forward? I don't think this is such a major issue. We thank National Treasury.
No, sir. My
yes,
my follow up on that other question, the board one. Remember, I wanted to make a follow up
on the board.
Yeah, I just want to understand from the DG. I would assume that that board was constituted in accordance with a specific act. I'm not sure whether it's that Special Pension Act or what. And surely if it's no longer in existence, it should be also by way of legislation. I just want to check if there's been any amendments or there was any legislation to give effect to the doing away with that particular board. Hence, now you have to go the trouble of going through the course to get this corrected, or what is the situation?
Yes, there was an amendment act of the Special Pensions Act. One, two, the board could not exist ad infinitum because it was dealing with something that was not continuing. In other words, there would have been people who were involved in the struggle and stuff. You verify, and then once you have them in place on board in the pension thing, then you disband. So it has been done in terms of the law, the amended version. He says that Section 27,
the one that dissolved.
That dissolved. So the option we're left with, we have explored almost everything. I mean, then we may miss something, but in this court route.
Honourable members, your question has been replied to. Silence. Thank you. Thank you to National Treasury. Also, thank you to National Treasury's intervention in Kamisberg Municipality. It's a question I put to National Treasury at the end of 2011, and there was intervention on the 18th of January this year. There's definite improvement, and for the first time in 5.5 years, there's an increase in the own revenue of Kamisberg because they're adhering to the recommendations by Treasury, but also the Auditor General is captured in the management letter that serves as the action plan. Just a few remarks before we end this session. Working through the annual report, and I did that this weekend, the government departments are allocated a lot of money. And with our engagements also through the Select Committee on Appropriations, we believe that there will have to be a more serious engagement between National Treasury and the national, but also the provincial departments. Also looking at the issue of wasteful, fruitless expenditure. If you look at the AG's report, we see those reports. That will have to be zoomed on. In terms of the processes, referring to the PFMA, in the MFMA, the last one referring to municipalities. And then, that criminal charges should be laid against those found guilty of abusing the state's money, public funds. This committee wants to put that on the table, that we are very serious about that, that Parliament is serious. With those remarks, we thank Treasury again. We are going to suspend the proceedings for 10 minutes to have our coffee and our tea. Come back. It's now 10 minutes past 11. Be back at 20 minutes past 11 and then take the other two submissions or presentations. Thank you, Mr. Waziri.
What do you mean? What's your point? No, no, no. I'm talking the
take the, some of the names which are there and put it in
the contacts are all
they are all there. So let us
write them.
Yeah, I think we'll save the environment by not writing that and just put it. It's exactly the same.
You see, exactly the same content.
Anyway.
question. No, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank
On your way out, can you please ask Rulani to come in and the other people? Members, we are back in session. Thank you. The second submission or briefing will be by the Corporation for Public Deposits on their report and financial statements for the year 2010-2011, including the report of independent auditors on the financial statements and performance information. We are also making history today
It's the first time that we in the NCLP on this specific committee will receive such a presentation. And as I indicated when we started, we will engage with the leadership that we do these meetings jointly when the reports are tabled in Parliament, jointly with the Standing Committee for Finance, because there's room and space on Fridays to have joint sessions to deal with issues of this nature. So welcome to the cooperation, and introduce yourself, please, and then you can zoom into your presentation. We are a bit behind time. It's now nearly 11:30. So we're going to stick to your presentation time if you take us to about till 12 o'clock. Will that be enough? 30 minutes?
That should be sufficient.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself just for record purposes.
Yes, thank you very much. Good morning, Chairperson.
Morning.
And honorable members of the committee. And thanks for the invitation for us to come and discuss the report and the financial statements of the Corporation for Public Deposits. As you quite rightly indicated, this is the first time that we appear before this committee, and we look forward to interacting with you. If, by way of introduction, if I may, our delegation today comprises myself as a deputy governor of the bank. My name is Daniel Minelle, and also the chairperson of the Corporation for Public Deposits. And I'm joined by my colleague, Ms. Nomolaze Skenjana, who is an assistant general manager in our financial services department, which is the unit in the bank that takes care of the administration and the accounting of the CPD. And if it meets your approval, and I'm very mindful of the time, what I would propose, Chair, is for me to just make some introductory comments, following which I would ask my colleague to just quickly take us through some of the key aspects of the financials, and thereafter then quite happily entertain any questions you may have. A copy of the presentation has just been circulated, and I would also like to apologize again for us not being able to get it to you ahead of time and not distributing it this morning. Given the time lines that we were given, it was a bit tight. Just by way of introduction and kicking off, and I think as members will be aware, the CPD is governed by its own act, the CPD Act, and is a fully owned subsidiary of the South African Reserve Bank. The corporation accepts call deposits from the public and invests these in short-term money market instruments and special treasury bills, and also places funds on call with the South African Reserve Bank. All the funds that are invested with the corporation are repayable on demand. The CPD has a board that assumes ultimate management responsibility for the corporation, which is chaired by a deputy governor of the bank, being myself, which is in line with the Act. The board is appointed by the Minister of Finance and comprises officials from both the National Treasury and the bank. There have been a couple of changes recently with regard to the board. However, during the period that we're reporting for, the following people served with me on the board. Mr. Roof Duploy, who in the meantime has retired from the service of the South African Reserve Bank. He used to be the head of the Financial Markets Department. The Honorable Director General, who was just with us now, similarly, following his appointment as DG, resigned from the board, and a new member from the National Treasury has been appointed. He served on the board in his capacity as the head of an assets and liabilities that he was before, and Ms. Brela Nokwana. So this is the essentially the board, and as far as the administration and accounting of the CPD, as is just indicated, this is performed by the Financial Services Department of the bank, with the accounting being performed by using the accounting systems and other infrastructure of the bank. And the head of the Financial Services Department serves as an alternate to the chairman on the board of the CPD and obviously attends the meetings as an executive officer of the CPD. The investment of the funds is undertaken by the Financial Markets Department of the bank, and similarly its head of department serves as a director of the committee. The investments of the funds are in accordance with investment guidelines that are approved by the board, and for governance purposes, which I'll talk about a bit later, we have now instituted a rule whereby every first meeting of the board every year, which tends to be in February, those investment guidelines are reviewed, any changes instituted and formally approved and given to the Financial Markets Department to work with. In accordance with the Act, the profits of the corporation after providing for an allocation to a reserve fund, we haven't done that for a number of years, but that's a provision in the Act, and for dividends, the balance is then paid over to government. And as a subsidiary of the bank, the financial results of the corporation are consolidated into the group financial statements of the bank. Owing to the scope and the risk profile of the CPD, over the years the board has adopted the view that it is not necessary to create an elaborate structure and appoint board committees to support it in discharge of its responsibility. And of course, as a 100% subsidiary of the bank, the CPD operates within the framework of the bank, which consists of structures and operations and controls that are in place to ensure that the CPD fulfills its mandate and complies with all applicable legal provisions and best practices as far as governance and risk management is concerned. We, you know, both internal and external auditors have unrestricted access to myself as the chairperson and to the board and, of course, to the records of the corporation. The internal audit evaluates independently the control processes and the governance and risk management of the bank and its subsidiary, which obviously would include the CPD. Members would have seen in the annual report that was circulated that we received an unqualified audit opinion, as part of which our auditors did not identify any control weaknesses and in the process confirmed that the statements comply with international accounting standards and were prepared in accordance with IFRS, allowing them to issue this this clean opinion that we've got. With those few introductory remarks, I'll just ask my colleague to run us through the developments in the year in terms of the actual financials before we get to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the approach is that we will focus on the significant items in CPD, which are not many. In their income statements, they have major categories as interest income and interest paid, and the underlying assets and liabilities that contribute to that. So for the year that we are reviewing, the net interest income, which is the net of interest income and the net interest paid, and the interest paid increased by 15.4 million, which is about 40%, as we reported it at to be 53.9 million for the 2011 financial year. The asset base and the deposits decreased by 5 billion, which is 1% compared to the previous year, due to government and major state-owned entities that had significant cash requirements towards year end. So it does not mean that deposits were low on average during the year. It's just big withdrawals right towards the reporting time. Despite the drop at year end, the average of investments and deposits held was significantly higher than the previous year, contributing to the increase in interest earned on investment and the interest paid on deposits when compared to the previous year. If we were to look at the major items of the income statement, which is now referred to as statement of comprehensive income, you would notice that the interest income increased by 37%, and that is mainly due to a decision that the board took to change the interest rate structure for the intergovernmental coordination, cash coordination, which the rate was actually increased by 10 basis points. The increase in average investments held as a result of the average in the deposit book also contributed to the increase, as earlier mentioned, that the number, the level of depositors and the level, the average throughout the year was much higher than the previous year. That has a direct impact in your interest. The second item of our income statement that is significant is the interest expense, and it obviously follows the same trend that the deposit book increased, not just in terms of number of depositors, which seems minimal, but by the amount of deposits now being deposited by the existing and the new CPD clients. The increase in deposit holding is mainly attributed to National Treasury's effort to encourage state-owned entities to invest excess funds with CPD, and we started to see that in this financial year, even though it was introduced in the 2010 financial year, but the results started coming through in the 2011 financial year. Now, moving to the statement of financial position, there's two major items in our balance sheet. It's investments and it's deposits as liabilities to the CPD. As previously reported, the asset base increased by 5 billion, as I have stated, to 11 billion. To 11 billion. But if you look at the average figures, the average that a deposit has held throughout the year increased by 56%, from 13 billion to 20 billion. And what happens then towards the year end, if you have the copy of the annual report, you will see there's a shift between the deposits, the investments in money market instruments and short-term deposits. And that shift is mainly to maximize the profitability of CPD, where cash requirements are not immediate for government. So we would move funds around or make funds available in immediate call deposits, depending on how government projects that they will require funds. So moving to the last item, which is the liabilities, mainly the deposit accounts. Call depositors have been classified into the following categories. We have IGCC, which mainly represents the governance spheres, public sector and public entities. And we have domestic private sector and we have foreign sector. Domestic private sector is mainly pension funds and provident funds, which is not part of IGCC. And the foreign sector is the neighboring states. The CPD does accept deposits from neighboring states, but on approval by the minister. And it is in line with the Act. The average deposits also maintained a high trend. We had the average of about 13 billion in the previous year, and because of what I have already illustrated, that the decision of National Treasury to encourage state-owned entities to invest excess funds with CPD, that rose to 20 billion on average throughout the year. So that actually concludes the significant items on our balance sheet.
Thanks, Nomre. Chair, that is the extent of our presentation. The corporation is obviously a vehicle to invest in the short-term public funds. The operation is a fairly straightforward one, as I indicated. It's essentially run out of the bank to obviously not incur costs, and we try and run it on a profitable basis. We have not in recent years made any adjustments to the reserve funds in terms of the amounts that by law can be deducted from the profits. The operating costs have been quite reasonable in terms of the structure that we've adopted. And as a result, the minister said, you know, whatever then remains get paid over to government anyway. So with that, I'll maybe hand over to you and then the honourable members for any questions that we can respond to.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I take members back, other members back to, I think, September 2010. We visited the Reserve Bank.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, 3 or 4 days in that boardroom. Yeah, it's coming back to my mind now. On the members, the research section also prepared a research document for us and there's a few issues raised. I put it to the members if there's any questions.
Balance story is really just reflective of
a snapshot type situation when you know, a balance sheet gets drawn at a particular date, and there was just a requirement from one of the SOEs for cash, and they withdrew. This was literally, I think it was a day or two before the end of the year, if I recall, but that was not indicative of a general sort of a drawdown or a reduction in the deposit levels. I mean, basically, we have seen further deposit growth post the financial year end. So that was literally a just a blip and a snapshot at the end of the year. The question that was asked about really what we invest in, it's basically it's short term instruments. Essentially, 60% of the investments that the CPD undertakes have got a maturity of less than 3 months, and in fact we don't invest in anything that's longer than 3 years, but as I say, 60% is very short. And what we're talking about there is things like, you know, treasury bills, obviously. We're talking about land bank bills and negotiable certificates of deposit. There are certain special treasury bills and bridging bonds, and the special treasury bills, which you'll be aware of, are very, very short-term instruments when unexpected cash flow demands arises from the treasury, that they would go very quickly and issue bills of a very, very short tenor to bridge essentially the time until they get their receipts in terms of their cash flow plans. So we would invest in those. Repurchase agreements, SARB debentures. So it's the typical money market instruments that are available, and clearly of the highest quality and of the highest issuer. So we very much very risk averse in terms of that. And the other issue that you raised, the rates are obviously market related, and the Treasury, as my colleague has said, in terms of enticing the state enterprises to use the CPD more, it allows, of course, for a pooling arrangement and a much more efficient planning of cash. They can't quite force them to deposit with the CPD. So there is an incentivization in that respect, which allows for us to pay them a little bit more than they would get from the commercial banks. But obviously, once we've tallied all up and we finish at the end of the year, whatever gets and obviously goes back to government and benefits the entire universe. In the process, though, a significant amount of money still moves backwards and forwards between the bank and the commercial banks, because that also helps in the overall management of domestic liquidity in the money market from a point of view of a monetary policy perspective. If we need to fine-tune liquidity backwards and forwards in the market, it's easier if we can then move the funds between the CPD and the commercial banks as such. So it's just really for efficient cash flow management purposes, and the amounts are significantly large that the commercial banks have not been impacted in any way to say that, look, now we've got the Reserve Bank competing with us for these funds. It's just more efficient cash management. The next question that was asked had to do with how often we review our risk management framework. That is done on a continuous basis. We've got the internal audit department that basically every year sets out its audit plan, which will include the subsidiaries and will include the CPD, as part of which they check our controls. We've got also the bank's internal risk management and compliance department that looks at the CPD issues. Our external auditors look at the controls, and they have obviously, as part of their report, indicated that they've seen no weaknesses in the control. So it's a continuous review of the risk management framework from different angles, from both the board in terms of when it meets, but as I say, also an independent evaluation from both the internal auditors and external auditors and the risk management compliance department. The overdraft situation that was asked and the necessity of it, again, is to allow the National Treasury, when they find themselves in terms of
mismatches from a point of view of when they would expect certain revenues to come in, be it tax receipts or whatever particular date. If things move by a couple of days, they tend to be very short term. It's in fact for a day, if they use that, or two. That's basically, again, just to make sure that they fund it efficiently and it gets returned immediately. And I'm not quite sure if I covered them all. The change in current assets.
Current assets.
Do you want to address that?
That reclassification was merely to fairly reflect the financial assets of the bank. There has been a move with a new statement being crafted for financial assets and the classification, and the information that's coming out of those debates highlighted to us that it is more appropriate to be fair value than held for trading. So that classification was actually informed by that. And when we were trying to align with the group policies, which is the South African Reserve Bank, we realized that assets of this nature are actually classified as fair value in the group statements of the bank. So to have harmonious consolidation, we then reclassified. But in terms of the fair value, it does not change because they yielded similar results. So the amounts did not change.
Yeah, and obviously, as my colleague has just said, a lot of it, apart from obviously consistency and harmonization with the group, was also driven by the fact that we continuously look at, you know, accounting standards that come out or any changes in terms of levels of disclosure that might be required from an IFRS point of view. And as far as the subsidiary statements are concerned, we fully comply with international financial reporting standards. That doesn't quite fully comply for the group statements as far as the bank is concerned, but even there, the approach that we adopt is one to say that we do not just not comply because it's convenient in certain issues. We take IFRS as a guideline. Where we deviate, it's because of certain issues that may be prescribed by the SARB Act, where we allow that obviously to take precedence, and issues where we think, given our mandate, certain levels of disclosures may not be appropriate. But where we deviate from IFRS, we have taken upon ourselves that we will explain and we will disclose in all instances. And some of the disclosures, by way of example, without belaboring the point, Chair, will have to do with instances where, if, as a central bank, as part of our duties, for instance, we had to provide emergency liquidity assistance to a bank as such, I mean, that would have financial stability implications if we had to disclose that and say, look, it was X bank that was a little bit wobbly at this and that stage. Even if it's after the effect, that could still create sensitivity. So in that sense, what we don't then comply with, we in the group statements, we then explain.
Members, are you covered on the list?
You know, Mr. Chairman, when you're giving examples, and even if they're hypothetical, they very often are based on fact, and I hope there is no bank that had liquidity.
That was literally an example and not based on fact.
Chairman,
that was their tongue in cheek, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, I'd also like to ask a question. You've got here your interest income and your interest expense. Interest expense, then, if I like it, quick calculation is about 15 million. That is your profit. That is all the cost included in this interest expense. Or what I'm actually asking is this a move to as a safeguard for the government against shortcomings in the cash flow? It's not to make a profit, actually. It's more to as a safeguard to take them through if something happens.
Certainly. I mean, the priority would not be to maximize profits in the corporation. And obviously, that difference would just relate to interest income versus expense in terms of what we pay the depositors as such. Of that, you still have to take off our operating expenses to get to our profits. Yeah. And we obviously set the interest rate at the board with regard to that, just to ensure that the corporation. operation, you know, doesn't operate at a loss, but it's not an idea of maximizing profits in that sense. And having said that, whatever comes out as profit goes back to government anyway.
Thank you for the reply. Just for interest sake, on page 2 of your report, your name is indicated as a chairperson, but who signed the document?
Sorry?
On page 2.
Yes, page 2.
Who is that person? Is it Lynch or Leach?
Not with you, Mr. Chair. On page 2 of
page 2 of this document?
Yes.
It's your name there printed.
Yeah, it's not the most beautiful signature, but it is me.
Is it you? Oh. I was just worrying.
It is supposed to be Minella, but...
Okay. No, thank you for that clarity. Honourable members, if there's no other questions, we thank the corporation for their submission, and we're looking forward for their second report to this, to the National Council of Provinces. What happened now? The corporation presented to Parliament. National Assembly's Committee, Standing Committee on Finance, plus the Select Committee on Finance in the NCP. Now it was presented to Parliament because a wrong impression is created outside.
Yeah.
When they submit to Parliament, they think it's the National Assembly, finish and clock. Today it's concluded to Parliament.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for your appearance before this committee. Honourable Makubela.
Chairperson, I'm seeing this documentation is as simple as 20 rand. Can we get also the type of paper so that we can print our own money?
On remember, we've got, as you know, we've got a subsidiary, the banknote company, that is responsible for printing our money. They've got two basic rules that people get told when they start working there. The first one is we don't take work home, and the second one is we don't give out samples.
You covered. Thank you. Thank you to yourselves. You are released. You're welcome to stay. And then we'll take the last presentation, the briefing by the Office of the Ombuds for Financial Services Providers. We've got three ladies there. Wow. It never happened in this committee that we get three ladies to do a presentation.
Chair, if I may, on the occasion of this visit that you reminded me of a couple of years ago, the committee did promise to come back. And we haven't seen you again. But we certainly would be an honor to host you in Pretoria again. Thank you very much.
To the team, very welcome here. Please introduce yourselves. Do we have a copy of their presentation? Every member has got this. Introduce yourselves and then you can zoom into your presentation.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Good morning, members. My name is Nolundu. I come from the Office of the Fire Ombuds. On my right hand side, thank you. I am the Ombud for Financial Services Providers. On my right-hand side, I have Xoliso Mhlongo. She is our financial manager. And on the extreme right, I've got Malani Murugan Modisi. She's our team resolution manager. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'll do is we've prepared a presentation. I'll just go through a few slides, and then I will hand over to Ms. Mhlongo to take you through the finances. and thereafter we'll all field questions if there are any. Thank you. So on page one, we set out our legislative mandate. Just to introduce ourselves, we were set up by means of what we refer to short as the Fires Act. We started operating in 2003. We were listed as a Schedule 3A entity on the 19th of September 2008. And so we carried on like that until the 31st of May 2010, when National Treasury issued a directive stating that the board of the Financial Services Board is going to be the accounting authority for the Fires Ombud. So our main objective as the Fires Ombud is to resolve complaints in terms of the Fires Act and the FISOS Act. So the FISOS Act refers to Financial Schemes Ombud Services Bill. It came later, around 2005, and the idea behind the FISOS Act was to bring within an ombudsman certain complaints that couldn't fall within either the Fires Ombud and many other ombudsmen. I'm on page two now, and just referring to the general overview, from the time we've been in existence, we've had a clean audit, and we talk about office growth. In 2005, during 2005, 6, and 6 financial years, we had about 17 staff members. As at 2010-11, the end of financial year, we had 41 staff members. Talking about growth and complaints, year-on-year growth has been around 14%. And around 2006, towards the end, we had about 3,806 complaints. And as at the end of year 2010-11, we closed off almost 8,000, around 7,944 complaints. At the bottom slide there, we just depict the year-on-year growth on complaints. We show a grey box at the bottom of each of the blue bars, and we write the name, the word justiciable. What we mean there is that although we received, for example, in 2005-06 financial years, about 3,800 complaints or some sort, it doesn't necessarily mean that all those complaints could be resolved by our office. Public members don't know what complaint to send to which ombudsman. So they'll send complaints to our office. We will then decipher where the complaint is supposed to go to. So when we say justiciable, it means it will end its life within in our office. We will resolve it. We'll do everything. On page three, we take you through our strategic objectives. Basically two main goals, talking about improvement of the complaints handling process to ensure quicker turnaround times and a cost-effective service. And the bigger goal, number two, talks to operational effectiveness. Then in the bottom slide, we talk about how we've fared against these goals. In respect of the process of improving complaints, we achieved about 70% of the activities we had put in a workflow implementation plan. And in respect of the number of cases we resolved within a 9-month period, we resolved 93%. Our target was 60%. We also had set for ourselves that we should have a quality control plan which should be completed by 31st March 2011. That plan was in place already by May 2010. We had also set for ourselves to have an automated contact handling process which would basically integrate our whole process of handling complaints. So what happened is, in respect of line one, we refer to a 70% achievement of the activities that we put in the workflow implementation plan, and we explain at the bottom there why we couldn't do the 30%. And all we're saying is we decided to shelve the remaining steps in the plan because they are contained in any event in the bigger IT projects that will be looked at during this current financial year. On the next page, we continue with performance information. Also within the banner of operational effectiveness, we had said for ourselves that we would want to have an IT strategy and plan approved by the 31st March 2011, and that was done. I will not, Mr. Chair, go through blow by blow in respect of all those items set out there in that slide, save to say that we have achieved what we had set out to achieve for ourselves. And now I'm going to hand over to my colleague to take you through the financial aspects of our operation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ombud. The first slide on financial statement is the report of the Auditor General. The audit opinion expressed by the Auditor General was an unqualified opinion, meaning that the financial statements fairly present in all material respect to the financial position of the Affairs Ombud as of 31st March 2011. In its financial performance, as is stated in the annual report. Then the report on other legal and regulatory requirements. These are based on and supported by the annual performance report. Predetermined activities, there were no material findings. Compliance with laws and regulations, there were no findings at all. Internal controls, and there were no significant findings. Coming to the overview of our financial statement, I will start with the statement of financial position, which is the balance sheet. There we have the main items are assets and liabilities, and then accumulated surpluses. Our non-current assets for the period under review, they increased by 70%. That is from 951,000 to 1.6 million. And included in these non-current assets were the office equipment, office machinery, computer equipment, and computer software. Coming to the current assets, the bulk of the current assets is account receivable, as reported at 5 million. But of that 5 million, 4.7 million, which is 94%, is FSB allowance. That is the amount that was remaining from the FSB allowance. Net trade receivable, which refers to the outstanding case fees, amounted to 104,000, which reflects an insignificant increase of about 2% over the prior year. Case fees are charged in terms of the FAIS Act. Coming to the funds and liabilities, total funds and liabilities amounted to 6.9 million. 5.7 million of that amount was accumulated surpluses from the previous year. That is from 2008 until 2011. 1.2 million of total liabilities is made up of account payables of 1.1 million, long-term lease of 70,000, short-term lease of 45,000. The next statement is the statement of financial performance, which looks into the income and expenses. The files on board only makes operating revenue from the case fees, as I've mentioned in the previous slide, that we charge case fees as per the FIES Act. So we only made last year, 255,600. The total expenses, so how do we, for instance, the Ombud has explained how we manage, how we've achieved the goals that we've set for ourselves. Then at what cost did we achieve what we achieved, that is the cost of service delivery. The total expenses for the year amounted to 22.4 million, an increase of 5% from the previous year's expenses. Personnel costs increased by 1%. General operating costs increased by 19% from the previous year. The two accounts were 65% and 34% respectively of the total expenses budget. The business of the FIES Ombud is executed entirely through human capital, hence the personnel cost of 65%. Because we only have operating revenue from the case fees,
that we will have an operating deficit at the end of the year. But that operating deficit is covered from the contribution from the FSB, and that is in terms of Section 22 of the Five Act. Below is just a slide that shows, it's just a pie graph that shows how the expense analysis, for instance, the operating cost, as I explained at the top. Then the financial statements and the risk and uncertainties. Financial risk. The phase on board has this very limited exposure to financial risk. In the main, we have the liquidity management, case management, and credit exposure. The credit risk that we have, as shown in the cash flow statement, was about 261,598, which is the balance held by the Standard Bank. We try to limit our exposure by managing our cash on a monthly basis. For instance, we don't keep, what happens is that we do request funds on a monthly basis from the FSB. So we don't keep funds in our, so we try to minimize that exposure. The phase on board maintains sufficient liquid resources to settle debt as they become due. The phase on board, for us to manage the case management risk, then we have a quality control plan that we put in place. The phase on board complies with the written principles of overall risk management. In our operation, we realize that we are exposed to a risk of not being able to get the talent that we look for in terms of the technical team. Therefore, we decided that we need to put some sustainability measures in place to ensure that we actually grow and develop the talent that is needed by the organization. That is reflected in our last slide on sustainability measures on human capital. In December 2010, we started this initiative. We are assisted by the Legal Education and Development. We started a recruit as graduate internship program whereby we source law graduates from law schools around the 9 provinces. The first batch was recruited and joined the FISE onboard in January 2011. The duration of the program is 12 months, and then the graduates, they have an opportunity to actually be absorbed in the system should opportunities arise. The program is now at its second year, and the second batch of the graduates started on the 2nd of January. They will finish on 31st December 2012. Thank you.
Thank you for this presentation, all the members. Yes, the annual report, I went through it unqualified with no findings. I wish we could get this from each national and provincial department and municipality in South Africa. But, questions?
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to the Ombuds and the team. Gaik and Colleen, I think there's nothing to apologize for. Sorry, that's just a play on someone's name. Mr. Chairman, I am a little ignorant about this, so please forgive me. What are the kind of cases that you deal with? And because I don't see a high profile like some other Ombuds on TV and so on. That's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. Don't take it too seriously, please. And then the case fee income. I mean, you draw down money from the Financial Services Board. So do all cases attract a fee? Or can someone who can't afford a fee come to you and get service from you? You talk about percentages of cases. Have you got actual numbers of how many there are? Number of complaints received in 2006, 3,806. And you've got some numbers there, but then you go on to the performance, and it's percentages. I mean, I know I've got the numbers there, but to relate them to your percentages isn't all that easy, but perhaps not that critical anyway. the staff complement. You've gone into an intern program, which is great. But what is your staff complement? I haven't got the annual report in front of me, and maybe it's in there anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've seen the report of the Minister, Prabh Gordhan, and the other solicitor. They used to quote these cases. I'll read them. Naidu versus Swanepoel, Van Zyl versus Lambert, as well as Dudley. Why it is... can you reflect the lesson learned from this financial sector? Because they used to quote these people. Okay. Given the fact that you operate within the sphere of protecting consumers, are there any collaborative programs, activities, or memorandum of understanding that has been put in place with the National Consumer Council? If so, what is the impact of such programs? Okay, the other one, can you account why there is a huge gap between the planned date and the actual achievement of the program with respect to the quality control plan? If so, is this an indication of over-projecting or a poor planning by the entity, so that it is seen as overperforming in its plan target? Okay, the last one, but two. Will you please explain the factors or reason for deviation in the original budget, and what has been done as a remedial action in order to avoid the recurrence? I think this is number last, yes. Why such high volume of cases are from Gauteng? You should also reflect the nature of cases. It seems as if it has been asked by Honorable Lees, this one. And then, yes, but why such a huge gap or high volume of cases from Gauteng? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure whether you're saying I could respond. Thank you. Before I start, Chair, I don't think we understood the question about the huge gap from the member. There's something about can we explain, and that was question three. Can we account why there's a huge gap, and that relates to something about implementation, quality control?
Yeah. Can the honourable member just give clarity to Ms.
All right, let me read the whole question because I try to cut it. Will you explain to the committee such a high volume of cases are from Gauteng? You mean that one?
No, that's not the question, sir. The question is actually number three. Can we account why there is a huge gap between something? Question four was about... the deviation from the original budget?
Right, no, this one.
Question three.
It's on the slides, on page three at the bottom slide.
Yeah, I'll give you the dates here. According to your report, the date of approval and the quality control, then it's a 31 March 2011. Here, just look, 31 May 2010, that gap, on page 58 of your report.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Shall I just kick off with that question straight away?
Yes. Okay.
We do our strategic goals a year before. So the strategic goals to be attained within financial year 11-12 would have been done in 2010.
Mm.
So even though the goal was to ensure that we have this by the end of 31st March 2011, we had already almost covered that step by 31st May 2010. That's what it means. Okay. All right. I think the indication was that I had to start with this member's question first. All right. What kind of cases do we deal with? We are set up to deal with cases that relate to the rendering of financial services. Sounds like Greek most of the time, but if we want to buy financial products, and financial products could include investments, could include insurance products, even if it's an insurance for our cars or homes or insurance over lives, or even something as easy as the unit trust investment, we speak to somebody. We say to this person, please help me. I want to do this with a little bit of money I have. Either I want to buy an insurance for a car, or I've got some extra money, I'd like to invest this money. Now, the interaction between the member of the public and the person that will be helping them, whom we refer to as providers in terms of the law, they call financial services providers, that person will be rendering a financial service to you. Now, most of the time, we don't know whether what we are being told by this supposed expert is in order. We will only know perhaps 2 years later, 3 years later, sometimes 10 years later. For example, when I'm involved in a collision and I lodge a claim with the insurer, then the insurer says, oh, you didn't tell me that you had 5 accidents before. I would never have insured you at this amount. And then I say, no, but nobody asked me that. Then they say, well, go and sort this out with your broker. All right? So in the past, before we had the FIS Ombud coming into existence, it would then be a game between the member of the public trying to address this problem with this provider. At some point, the provider would switch off the phone. There weren't even cell phones then. They wouldn't answer the telephone. The only option would then be to go to court. And when you go to court, there's an issue of resources. So it's not an issue, it's not an avenue that's available to everybody. So that is the nature of complaints we resolve. I hope I've explained thoroughly the notion of rendering financial services. So it's not just about, for example, I know people will say to us, my car hasn't been paid. The insurer told me that I was involved in a collision, my car has not been paid. And the insurer says to me, it wouldn't have been this damaged if I had maintained my tires properly. Now, that's a contractual term. We don't get involved in things like that. We get involved where there is something wrong that happened during the rendering of the financial service. Okay? The contract comes after the service has been rendered. But we accept that members of the public don't know those things. So when the complaint comes to us, we'll accept it. We write to the person and we'll say, all right, we've received your complaint, but after looking through it, we now decide it has to go to another office. This office, we will tell you, we'll give you the contact numbers and tell you that this office doesn't account to us. Okay? So we've copied you, we've copied those people, and off the case goes. They won't account to us. So you can't come back to us and say, well, I gave you that case on that such and such a year, because it is falling completely outside of our jurisdiction. Remember, we are set up by law. So we can't do things that the law doesn't allow us to do. So that's the type of complaints we handle, complaints that relate to the rendering of financial services in terms of the FIS Act. Then we come to another category of complaints, because we said earlier on, we resolve complaints in terms of the FIS Act, and we also said we resolve complaints in terms of the FISOS Act, that strange name. And I started by explaining that the idea behind was to ensure that no complaint doesn't go or doesn't fit within the remit of all the ombudsmen in South Africa, because there's many of us. But there are only two statutorily set up offices, and that's the pension funds adjudicator and us. So the FISOS Act was to ensure that if a complaint doesn't belong to all these other ombudsmen, then our office, wearing the hat of the FISOS ombud, will then entertain that complaint. So what type of complaints are those in simple English? Those are complaints where, first of all, the person that was helping you or the financial institution involved is not a member of any of these other ombudsmen. Okay? Now remember, there's a voluntary ombudsman and then there's a statutory ombudsman, and I mentioned there too. The voluntary ombudsman, you can only take a complaint there if the person you allege has wronged you or harmed you is a member of those schemes. But with the pension funds adjudicator or the FISE ombud, a person doesn't have to be a member. If the law has been violated, we will entertain the complaint. Okay, so in a nutshell, it's complaint relating to financial matters, but specifically which financial matters? In the first, on the one hand, in terms of the FISE Act, the complaint must relate to the rendering of a financial service. Something must have gone wrong when you were buying that insurance for your car. Something must have gone wrong when you were investing that money. You often will never know until such time that you want to have this benefit you were told about 7 years ago, and the benefit doesn't materialize, then you know something would have gone wrong, and still you won't know where it has gone wrong. Then you come to our office and we will know exactly where it has gone wrong, because the law is very clear on what people need to do. Take, for example, people going to a bank, and they say, look, I've got 80,000 rand, I'd like to leave this money here. And then papers are signed, the person walks away. 2 months later, school fees have to be paid. They're due and payable. The person remembers, I've got 80,000 in the bank. They go there, they say, no. This money is now kept in another investment for 5 years. And you know what? If you want to take that money, you're going to lose a lot. Then a disagreement breaks up. But you didn't tell me that this is going to be 5 years. Then they say, look, but the papers have been signed. What can we do? So then people find our way to our office. The law says, at that instance, the provider is supposed to tell you to come to us. I'm not sure that they do that, but people do come to our offices. And so when they come, then we will then ask the bank, all right, what made you decide that a five-year investment is relevant? Did you ask him whether he's got money kept away for emergencies? And all of these things is in the law, okay? So then we will resolve the complaint. So we know exactly what has happened and where something would have gone wrong. And there is an example of something going wrong within the rendering of financial services. FISOS Act I've already highlighted to ensure that no complaint cannot be entertained by the ombudsman within the country. So if this person that has harmed you is not a member of any of the voluntary schemes, but there is still a financial transaction going on, and you have a financial institution on the other side, we will then, wearing the hat of the FISOS ombud, entertain that complaint. I hope I've clarified that question enough. The second question talks about case fees. Do all cases attract a case fee? The answer is no. The Act is very clear. Only when we accept a complaint for investigation can we charge a case fee. Now, all these complaints come in on a daily basis. By the time we walk in at 7 o'clock, the fax is full, you know, emails are full, and then we go through, sift the complaints. And ordinarily, in terms of the law, we're supposed to notify the other person that a complaint has been lodged against them and allow them a 6 weeks period within which they can resolve the complaint with their client. Remember, this is their client. Okay? So here's your complaint from your client. Please deal with your client directly. And we are required by law not to interfere within that 6 weeks period unless we have evidence that this person, the complainant, has been there and there's been no help, and we've got proof in writing. Then we're allowed, in terms of the law, to reduce the period to say, you've had your chance, you were allowed 6 weeks in terms of the law, but we're giving you 7 days now. So if the person is still not able to resolve the complaint, then we then say to them, right, we now want your answer to this complaint. We're now going to be investigating this complaint, and we are now entitled to charge you a case fee. So the answer is, not all complaints that are received are charged the case fee. It's only when we get to a point where we are accepting the case for investigation. All right, yes. There was also the issue of to whom is the case fee charged. The case fee is charged against the person against whom the complaint is made. So it's not the member of the public that has to pay the case fee. It is the firm, okay? The firm against whom the complaint is directed must pay the case fee. And it's 1,000 rand. It's limited to 1,000 rand. Then there was the question of can members of the public come in even though they have no money for the case fee? That already is answered because the complainant doesn't pay a case fee. All right, then we need to answer the question about percentage of cases related to numbers. Okay, we tried to talk about performance in terms of percentages. There is a slide where we say, that's page 3 at the bottom there. We talk about performance information. One of the things we say in bullet number 2 is that we had set for ourselves the target of 60%. So it's 60% against the 7944 we received in 2010-11. Okay? So it's 60% of the 7944 we received. Okay? And we say, we don't just want to resolve these complaints, but we want to resolve them within a 9-month period. Now, the 9-month period is calculated taking into account the normal life things where, for example, the Act doesn't want us to interfere within the first 6-week period because the provider is required to resolve this thing with their client without the office interfering. Then you can have requests by either party. Complainant might say, listen, I'm going to hospital, I'm taking my child overseas, etc., etc., the normal life things that happen. And eventually you would find yourself going to a 5th month where you haven't really had a breakthrough in the complaint. But we've put pressure on ourselves and we said at least 60% of our complaints need to be resolved within a 9-month period. And against that 60%, we resolve 93%. We can then work out 93% of 7944. Okay. All right. Then the other question related to what is the staff complement? We are 41. We were 41 as at 2010-11. Is there anything I've left out?
Yeah, I'll take the one on the deviation and budget.
Okay.
I'll start by explaining that the work of the fair ombudsman is very specialized. So for employees, for staff, for instance, the issue of the deputy ombudsman, you really need somebody who knows the work of the office, who knows what the ombudsman has been talking about. So if, for instance, somebody in a critical position like the deputy ombudsman, that position is not filled, then it has an impact on the budget. For instance, the deviation comes mainly from the personnel cost due to that fact of the deputy ombudsman. But you also ask us what measures have we put in place to actually ensure that doesn't happen. In our strat plan for 12-13, 11-12, we have to have a succession plan. That succession plan is in place. We've identified critical positions and we've identified potential candidates within the organization. And we've identified gaps so that this year we put up a training program to bridge those gaps so that we don't fall into the trap of not having been able to fill the position, the critical position that we have. So we build the capacity within.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There were several questions that came from Mr. Makovela. I will now ask Melanie to respond to the rest of the questions. Starting off with the Naidu versus Swanepoel, the Dudley, Sandelen versus Lambert, what exactly were the issues and what lessons were learned in those cases? All right. What we say there actual annual report, we give a brief synopsis of what the case was all about. All three complaints related to members of the public, A. Mr. Naidu, A. Dudley, and Van Zyl, where they invested money in what is commonly known as a property syndication, public property syndication. They lost money. They didn't understand that the investments were high risk because they weren't told by the providers that there's a high risk investment. Not everybody has got appetite for a high risk investment. When the money had, in their view, when they'd lost their capital, they then came to our office to say, I met a Mr. So-and-so, Swanepoel, in the Naidu case. Swanepoel didn't tell me that my money is going to be invested in a high-risk investment. I'm a pensioner. I'm X number of years. I can't afford to go, and if I have no access to capital, I want you to help me. So the same thing happened to Dudley, also a pensioner, lost money in a property syndication, and the same goes for Van Zyl. So what then happens is we take these complaints to the provider and we say, tell us what happened here. In your own, give us your own story. And of course they'll give us their story. They're in business, remember. We sold the product to this person. The person understood very clearly that this was a high-risk investment. And of course we use the Act. The FIVE Act is a good enabler. It tells us exactly what we need to ask. Then we say, all right, give us proof that you did disclose to the person that this was high-risk, and tell us exactly in your own words what you understand about a high-risk product. In respect of all three, actually, there was also issues relating to just general governance, risk management within the schemes, where money is alleged to have been lost, not because it was a normal economic activity relating to the market movements, etc. There were allegations of people paying themselves out of investors' monies, covering their overheads out of investors' monies, and members of the public have got no way of knowing those things. It is for the provider to research about a product they want to sell and recommend to people, especially the elderly, who don't have access to capital again. So we then found against the brokers in respect of the three cases, and we asked them to compensate the people involved. But we also say there's a lesson there, not just for the brokers themselves, but it's also for the members of the public to say, look, if it's too good to be true, it is. Probably is too good to be true. Because these people were told about returns of 15%, 18% in an economic climate that was delivering, you know, very low single-digit returns. So if a person is telling you that, look, I can give you a 20% return in an economic climate where those things are not available anywhere else, and obviously something is not right there. So we say in the annual report that there's something to learn for members of the public as well. We also discovered that most of these brokers didn't know the products they were selling. And the warning we issue there is, don't sell something you don't know, because you can't tell your client anything about something you don't know at the end of the day. So that's in a nutshell what happened in respect of those cases. They're not the only cases involving property syndication investments, but we just isolated these three. The next question was about, are there any corroborating programs that we have relating to, I presume, consumer awareness campaigns? I will start by saying, and this is not defensive, if you look at the FIRE Act, it says the activity of informing consumers about the FIRE Ombuds office resides with the FSB. The Act says that that responsibility resides with the Financial Services Board, not with us. However, we're not relaxing. We know there's an inherent responsibility we have here to educate members of the public. As a result of that, whenever we get the opportunity to address members of the public in forums, we go there. We are now partnering up with Treasury, with the Consumer Education Initiative. We're due to go there, I think, next week at Treasury. You must also remember, the fact that we are not required to do this means we won't have fun. So we need to be part and parcel of other people. Okay? I hope that takes care of that. Then there was something about why such a high volume of complaints from Gauteng, and can we also reflect the nature of the cases? The best we can do in the annual report is to say, well, this this number of complaints related to investments, this number of complaints related to insurance products. We wouldn't specifically say, okay, this is a retirement annuity, this is a, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We also say the provinces, but I can't really understand why most of our complaints come from Gauteng, because people do reach us. People from all over South Africa reach us. And, you know, people call from a coin box often, and the phone gets cut, and, you know, if they've given us the number, immediately we can call them back, and, you know, those things. I still do believe, and all the members of our office believe, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of educating consumers in a more focused way. Did I leave out anything?
I just wanted to add to that. I think if you look at those percentages, just, you know, reflects the current levels of economic activity in the country. You know, Gauteng obviously has the greatest concentration, and then followed by KZN, and then the Western Cape. I think people in those provinces have access to institutions, branches, maybe more opportunities for things to go wrong than in the other provinces. Also, if you look at provinces like the Eastern Cape, the Free State, Mpumalanga, Limpopo, access to main cities where information about our office would be available is more difficult. You know, some are from in the Eastern Cape in the rural areas, but I find it more difficult to get into a city where they could possibly fax through complaints or, you know, you contact people who could assist them with that.
Thank you, honourable members. Are you covered? Thank you to Mrs. Baum for the presentation. If you look at the panel report, the document, and you look at the gender, it's very interesting. The ladies are very prominent in this organization. But thank you for the work you are doing.
Thank you.
If we look at the remarks of the Minister for Finance, that it says it's impressive to note the seriousness of which the fires in Umbut is taking public service and accountability, and to give a service to the consumers outside. That's very important. That the people outside have got a place to go to, institution where they can put their case, and attention is given to it. So thank you for your presentation. The committee report will be now compiled and be submitted also then to Parliament, to the National Council of Provinces. I just want to mention in his absence that I told the meeting that we appreciate the presence of the Deputy Minister for Finance. Since 2009, these two ministers, the Minister for Finance and the Deputy Minister, were consistent in attending meetings of this committee and also appropriations, setting an example to all the committees in Parliament. I want to put it on record, although he has left, because some of my colleagues are also having meetings without the political leadership. I don't think it is correct. Honourable members, now thank you very much. Our next engagement will be with our strategic plan, 15-16 May. Next week is Appropriations Week of the Chinese Committee. And the program has been circulated, so please look at your program, diarise the dates for the month of May. Actually, the program goes until June. That brings us to the end of this meeting. Thank you again for your attendance here and your presentation. The meeting stands adjourned.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Thank you, members.
Yeah.
Parlamento.